Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the testimony today from the White House counterterrorism chief John Brennan, whose nomination to head up the CIA drew sharp questions from hawks and doves on the contentious issues of drone policy and assassination authority. A former CIA official, Melvin Goodman, the author of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, joins us to discuss recent efforts to pry secrets from the White House over its drone policy. Then, since John Brennan is considered the architect of the drone program and his testimony today was delayed due to protesters expressing outrage that the U.S. government operates what many consider to be an assassination program with limited oversight that is not subject to international law, we'll look into the size and scope of the drone program. Bill Roggio joins us. He is the editor of the Long War Journal, which is considered the leading authority on the numbers of drones the U.S. has and how many targets they have struck in what countries and the extent of collateral damage involved in these strikes. Then finally, we'll speak with economist James Galbraith about the standoff in Washington over the future of the economy and the nation's economic recovery that has repeatedly been held hostage by congressional Republicans trying to get tax cuts for their wealthy donors and cut government programs they don't like or want to privatize. We will discuss whether, as some have suggested, that before they cause another recession, the Congress should take the Hippocratic Oath on the economy. Joining us now is Melvin Goodman, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service in the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. In 1991, he was one of three former CIA officials to testify before the Senate against the nomination of Robert Gates as Director of Central Intelligence on the grounds that he had slanted intelligence to suit policy. He's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melvin Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again.
And what was your impression of how John Brennan handled himself today, given that, of course, initially the proceedings were interrupted by protesters who were clearly expressing outrage at the fact that, I guess, he's most identified as the architect of the drone program. What was your sense of how he equipped himself?
Well, I think John Brennan handled himself very well, but I thought he had a very easy time of it. I thought the committee was particularly feckless. It reminded me of about 8 years ago when Michael Hayden, General Hayden, was up for confirmation, and no one asked Hayden about the warrantless eavesdropping he was responsible for when he was director of the National Security Agency. Here, there were so many things that Brennan could have been asked and could have been pressed on, particularly the details of the memo that talks about targeting Americans, that referred to a high-level official who was informed if he saw an imminent attack could make the decision to kill an American without any checks and balances, without any review, without any accountability. Who is an informed high-level official? In what agency? At what level is a high level? What do they mean by an imminent attack? Are they talking about the same kind of an intelligence that we used to go to war against Iraq in 2003? And then there were some prior issues that should have been raised with regard to Brennan, which led to the president not nominating him in 2009, when clearly Brennan was a big supporter of extraordinary renditions and was sort of Tenet's spokesman on the Sunday morning talk shows with that regard, with Brennan always claiming that I never had operational authority for the policy. Well, no, he wasn't in that position. He was essentially a high-level staff assistant, but he was the person who was the public face for the CIA. And then what really bothered me that didn't get challenged today, Brennan has always claimed that torture and abuse led to information that led directly to the killing of bin Laden. Now we have apparently a classified 6,000-page Senate Intelligence Committee report. He claims to have read the summary of it, and he said he was shocked by the findings and can no longer say that intelligence from torture and abuse led to the killing of bin Laden. Well, I think this is a classic case of willful ignorance. If Brennan wanted that kind of information about the sadistic torture, the kind of sadistic torture that was on the torture tapes that were destroyed by a CIA operations officer, I think he could have could have gotten that information. There's no reason for him to be shocked at this time and saying he may have to change his opinions on certain things. So I found it an appalling performance by the committee, but given Dianne Feinstein's delicate handling of the committee over these recent years, I can't say I was surprised. But I think we were led to believe there would be a few more fireworks than we got.
Well, Melvin Goodman, it seemed as if with Ron Wyden, his letter and the leak to Michael Isikoff of NBC News, that they were really trying to smoke the White House out. And, of course, Dianne Feinstein has said that in her opening statement that she intends to propose legislation to create a new court to oversee the targeted killings. How sincere are they about it? Because I assume that in their positions on the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, they have access to a lot of information. Now, they're saying that the White House would only give this information to the principals and not to the staff. What's your sense of whether they're posturing and whether they really want to know, or whether indeed they're happy to allow the president to have this sort of, you know, hold the bag on this?
I think the committee, particularly the Chairman Feinstein and the Democrats, want to give the impression that they're holding a rigorous hearing. So they cannot be challenged on the kind of hearing that we've seen so far. So they're giving the impression of some criticism of Brennan and some willingness to challenge Brennan. But overall, you had people like Jay Rockefeller, Barbara Mikulski, Mark Warner, who were cheerleaders for Brennan. When there were serious issues that needed to be discussed, no one brought up Benghazi in the context of Benghazi, not as a consulate, which I really don't think that it was. It was an intelligence platform. This wasn't a State Department disaster. This was a CIA disaster and a CIA security problem and a CIA failure. But Brennan should have been asked about that. Brennan should have been asked about Iran and the various covert action programs and the policies toward Iran and the failure of intelligence with regard to the Arab Spring a year and a half ago. He wasn't asked about that. Brennan should have been asked about the fact that the Inspector General has been severely weakened at the CIA, which is the major body for internal oversight within the intelligence community. So there were so many things that needed to be discussed. I thought Wyden was serious. I thought Chambliss, the vice chairman of the committee, did a pretty good job. And Susan Collins from Maine is always pretty solid. But overall, I think the document about legalized killings of Americans is disturbing. I thought the hearings today were disturbing.
Again, I'm speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. In 1991, he was one of three former CIA officials to testify before the Senate against the nomination of Robert Gates as Director of Central Intelligence on the ground that he had slanted intelligence to suit policy, and he's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. And his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. Now, you just mentioned the minority chair, Senator Saxby Chambliss, who's retiring apparently. I thought he asked a key question where he asked Brennan whether he would rather kill terrorists than put them in prison. Brennan's reply was, I have never believed it is better to kill a terrorist than to detain him. But my understanding is that is not so. I mean, isn't it true that one of the rationales for using drones against these so-called high-value targets is that the argument is, well, it'll cost us more lives to go into the inhospitable no-man's land on the Afghan-Pakistan border than it would to zap them with a drone?
Exactly. I think that's one of the biggest changes we've seen since the Bush administration and the Obama administration. The Bush administration used the drone rather carefully in a calculated fashion, because I think the emphasis, and I think the generals supported this, and so did the CIA station chiefs supported this, that it was better to capture these terrorists and try to elicit information. But under Obama, I think they're trying to kill as many individuals as possible. We've seen 400 of these flights that have killed more than 3,000 people, and it was Brennan in a press conference 2 years ago who said, we haven't killed any civilians. we know that's not to be the truth either, and he should have been pressed on that. But again, nothing was forthcoming. I mean, he is the architect for this policy. He is Obama's man for the use of the drone for targeted killings, the same policy that we have told the Israelis is the wrong policy to be conducting in Gaza and the West Bank, and it's exactly what we're doing in countries where we have no declaration of war, no state of war, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. Now we're looking for a base in Niger that will probably conduct operations against Mali and Libya and Nigeria. I mean, it's expanding. And maybe some of this will come up in the classified session, the secret session that will be held on Tuesday, but more could have been asked in this particular session. And at the very end, what I found most troubling on Brennan's part was, I want this committee to be an advocate for the CIA. Well, no, we don't want the Senate Intelligence Committee to be an advocate for the CIA. It was created in the mid-1970s after CIA abuses by the Church Committee's piece of legislation, because it was supposed to monitor the CIA. It was the external oversight body for the CIA. So, you know, this committee doesn't understand its role, and Brennan doesn't understand what the committee is supposed to be all about. So it made for a very disturbing picture over a three-hour period this afternoon.
Well, Mel Goodman, I'm sort of disturbed by the notion that what we're talking about here ultimately is oversight over assassinations. The very fact that, you know, you have to have oversight over assassinations. I thought that they were banned by the Church Committee back then. That you
exactly.
And now, you know, clearly the drone program, it's not the instrument that we're talking about. It's what it does. It's a tool of assassination, you know. So
exactly. And it's a tool of assassination that's administered and orchestrated by the President of the United States without any checks, without any balances, without any oversight or accountability. And Eric Holder, the Attorney General, gave a speech about a year ago in which he said there was a question about due process. And Holder said in a remark that I find unfathomable, due process doesn't mean a judicial process. Well, what could due process be if it isn't a judicial process? And then in a recent press conference, you had someone like Jay Carney said that the policy of these targeted killings is legal, ethical, and wise. Now, I think that statement could be challenged on all fronts. You even have retired CIA officials, operational officials with a lot of experience in that area, who feel that it's not wise, that it's counterproductive over the long term. And Stanley McChrystal, General McChrystal, says in his book, it's creating more terrorists and insurgents than it could ever annihilate. So we've got to stop to look at the long term, look at the strategic implications, look at the role of the United States in the Middle East in the wake of two unwinnable wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and how long are we going to persist with this policy of targeted killings where even Americans are involved? You know, everyone on both sides of the desk today, the committee and John Brennan, were quite satisfied that, yeah, the killing of Awlaki was quite legitimate and even legal. Well, why didn't someone ask about 2 weeks after Awlaki was killed, his 16-year-old son, who happens to be an American citizen, was also killed in a drone attack. So he's one of the four or five American citizens who've been killed, going back to 2002 in Yemen. Again, these things just never came up.
Well, just in the last minute, Melvin Goodman, what is going on with Obama? I mean, he is supposed to be a liberal or a centrist, but he's more hawkish on national security than any recent president. And I imagine he feels that that's good for him in terms of the American center. It obviously is upsetting a lot of his liberal supporters. He's gone after Kirikou, for example, the CIA guy, which I find mystifying, because any reporter can find out who's a station chief anywhere in the world. I mean, it's not, and yet the guy's going to jail. He's really been very hawkish, and I'm curious.
Well, it's been a public. I mean, you say he's a liberal and a centrist, and I would agree, but he's also a constitutional lawyer. And look at his unwillingness to invoke the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, the Eighth Amendment to the Constitutions that deal with illegal searches and seizures, that deal with due process, that deal with a fair and speedy trial. I mean, I'm not carrying a brief for Bradley Manning, but he's waited nearly 3 years to go on trial for the release of documents to WikiLeaks. So there are a lot of issues on the constitutional side that remind us of what President Eisenhower said about the danger of permanent war, the impact it will have on civil liberties. Well, we're certainly seeing that in this country. We have permanent war. He doesn't call it the global war on terror, but Obama is still fighting a global war on terror, and as a result, there are serious civil liberties issues that need to be discussed. One final point about something that Brennan should have been asked about. Brennan has been very laudatory of a program in New York, the New York Police Department, versus the Muslim community there. This is a program that's harassed the Muslim community. It's led to no leads that have led to a criminal investigation. And it's been defended by Brennan, where one of his former colleagues, head of operations at the CIA, David Cohn, is head of the Intelligence Bureau of the New York Police Department. You know, why didn't this come up?
Sure. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. It's always good to be with you.
And we'll catch up on your book soon. Again, I'm speaking then with Melvin Goodman, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and U.S. Army. In 1991, he was one of three former CIA officials to testify before the Senate against the nomination of Robert Gates as Director of Central Intelligence on the grounds that he had slanted intelligence to suit policy. He's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the scope and nature of the drone program. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bill Roggio, who is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and the editor of their publication, The Long War Journal, which provides original reporting and analysis of the global war on terror. Coverage includes strategic and operational issues relating to the war in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, and Lebanon, as well as al-Qaeda's operations, tactics, and strategy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Roggio.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
And your journal, The Long War Journal, is considered the Bible, if you will, on the drone program, how many strikes, et cetera, have taken place. What is your understanding of the fleet of drones? What are the numbers?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's well into the hundreds and could be in the thousands, depending on what types of drones you're talking about. As far as the armed drones, the commonly used Predators and the more deadly Reapers, which is just pretty much the younger brother that carries more missiles, they're in the hundreds for those drones, and they're operated both by the Air Force and by the CIA. And then you have a whole series of unmanned drones that are used to conduct either tactical or strategic level intelligence. So the U.S. Air Force, I believe right now, is in the next year, is going to be buying more unmanned than manned aircraft.
So I've heard figures that there are at least 350 operational in the AFPAC region. Would that gel with your understanding?
Yeah, that would. The number varies, and it's really difficult to know how many exactly the CIA is operating. The U.S. military operates, I know they operate hundreds in Afghanistan. It's hard to know, again, how many of those are actually are the attack drones, the drones that are armed with Hellfires, and how many of those are just in a surveillance mode.
So according to your journal, the Long War Journal, Bill Rogier, of which you're the editor, there have been at least 322 U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan since January of 2008. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And what are the numbers for Yemen? Because that's obviously a lot of questions have come up today in the confirmation hearing of John Brennan, who was a former CIA station chief in Saudi Arabia, and he's essentially been directing, as the head of counterterrorism in the White House, been directing a lot of these drone strikes, and it seems that an awful lot have taken place in Yemen. And that,
over 50 strikes in Yemen since there was one strike back in 2002. It was actually the first armed drone strike that killed an al-Qaeda operative, as well as an American citizen that was with him. And then since 2009, the U.S. has conducted both, not just drone strikes, but they've conducted airstrikes and cruise missile strikes against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But over the last 2 years, those pretty much have morphed over to being drone strikes almost exclusively. And we had 42 of those recorded just last year.
And they operate out of Djibouti, the former French colony. Oh, I think it's currently a French colony as well, in terms of the base.
They operate from Djibouti. There's it's just been recently disclosed there's a drone base in southern Saudi Arabia. It's thought that some are actually maybe operating from within Yemen. And then there's been talk of a base in the country of Oman, which is next door to Yemen as well. So again, it's really difficult to know where the strikes are actually being launched and how much of this is real and how much of this information is disinformation.
Well, there have been reports recently about the Mali operation that the French are undergoing against what's called al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And I was reading that the U.S. drone base in Djibouti is basically thousands of miles from Mali, and it's a long haul. And they're looking around for somewhere closer to place drones. Is that your understanding?
Yes. There's been a report that a base is going to be opened in Niger. And the administration, or the U.S. military and CIA, have also been flying manned surveillance flights from bases in other African countries in the area. But they're really seeking to build that base in Niger to step up operations against al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Now they're talking these drones will just be surveillance. However, we've heard that before in other situations, and these drones wind up being armed.
So, Bill Rogier, again, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and the editor of their publication, The Long War Journal. What's your understanding about what U.S. drone activity is taking place over Syria? I've heard reports that U.S. drones have been monitoring human rights abuses for potential trial of the Assads, if indeed they don't end up going down in flames with the whole country, frankly.
I've heard rumors. It's always difficult to know how true this is, and it's quite possible that that U.S. drones could be mistaken, and instead they may actually be Israeli as well, and it's possible they're being launched from Turkey as well by the U.S. I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. The drones have a bevy of roles, and intelligence gathering is one of the biggest roles for them. The Syrian Air Force would have the capability to shoot them down. Honestly, drones are not a very sophisticated airframe. They don't fly very fast. They hover over long periods of time just because of that. And, you could shoot down a drone with a World War II aircraft. So if the Syrians detected one, I'm sure they'd be more than happy to shoot it down. But they may actually be having their own problems to deal with the Free Syrian Army and groups like the Al-Nusra Front and others who are an al-Qaeda, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate, and other Islamist groups and rebel groups that are operating there.
So let's turn, Will Roggio, to, as you know, in the hearings today for John Brennan to be the next head of the Central Intelligence Agency, they had to postpone the hearings because of interruptions. And there's no question that the issue of drones elicits a lot of passions. People find the idea of this ability to assassinate people from a long distance without any fingerprints and without any attribution extremely troubling, and there's a concern that there may be blowback in the future. What is your understanding of the ratio between the targeted killings and the collateral damage?
Yeah, you know, in Pakistan, the numbers, according to my numbers, and I want to be very clear, it's extremely difficult to determine when civilians are killed and when enemy is killed. I'm basing my reporting on press reports from both Pakistani sources, which I feel have the most incentive to keep to keep those numbers realistic, as well as the foreign news agencies, which I think take great care in their reporting. In Pakistan, it seems to be around 10%. I wouldn't be surprised if that number was 20 or 30%. The reality is having a civilian-free conflict in a war is nearly impossible, particularly when you're conducting an air campaign. The reality is that the reason we don't know is because this is indeed enemy-controlled territory. So you can't just go in there and conduct a bomb assessment of what happened. But from what I'm looking at and from seeing even how the Taliban and how Al-Qaeda and other groups, when they do issue statements on these raids, they do often seem to match the press accounts that I'm reading. And there are some very high-level Al-Qaeda leaders that are killed during these raids. Al-Qaeda just announced today that this one operative who was phone conversations taped by the Italian intelligence was conducting operations for more than 20 years, probably had knowledge of the 9/11 attacks, he was involved in the Luxor massacre in Egypt in 1997, traveled through multiple theaters, and then we know we've killed some of Al-Qaeda's senior-most leaders in these strikes, and often killed with those individuals are either their families, who are being put in harm's way by those leaders, or their associates, their bodyguards, their lieutenants, their aides, things of that nature. So a lot, you know, and then there are instances where there are civilians killed, and that often does come out in the press reporting. But I think when you look at this historically, the number of civilian casualties are low. It's not a zero sum game that's being played here. It's not a game at all, obviously. But there's just no zero sum outcome. You can't just kill bad guys or just kill civilians when you're conducting any type of military operations, especially with an enemy that is mixing itself within the civilian population. Not only does it live in Pakistan's tribal areas, it also rules a lot of them, which puts them automatically in the midst of the people.
So from your point of view, Bill Roggio, there are two questions. One is, what's your understanding of the outrage and indignation that's felt by a lot of American citizens, many of whom demonstrated today in the U.S. Senate, and the reports that you get on the receiving end that these attacks may do more harm than good in as much as they make the people in that area, in, say, Fatah on the border there, feel so helpless and humiliated by this unseen power that it's more likely to recruit more Al-Qaeda than it is in terms of killing off their leadership?
Yeah, you know, as far as the recruiting for the enemy goes, there's no doubt that the drones are a tool used in recruitment. However, there's indications, and you see this in polling and press reports, that there's a lot of Pakistanis living in the tribal area who are living under the boot of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban that actually support these strikes, too. You'll see them often quoted in news articles. A lot of times when they're Pakistani minders that are ushering reporters around, when they get them aside, they'll say, you know, more of these strikes. Now, that being said, given that the Taliban rule these areas, it's easy for them to recruit and it's easy for them to dominate the narrative. One of the problems I do have with the drone program is I think it is definitely being overused. And what the administration is doing is it's substituting a tactic, which is the drones, and using them to target senior and mid-level leadership and fighters in terrorist groups. It's using that tactic as its strategy, and the strategy has to deal with the three core, in my opinion, are the three core issues: state sponsorship of terrorism, which Pakistan is one of them, the al-Qaeda and terrorist groups' ability to dominate in ungoverned areas and operate successfully in ungoverned areas. Mali's just being the latest example of that. And the radical ideology that is being spread. And we have no strategy to deal with any of those issues. So instead, what we're doing now is what the Bush administration was roundly criticized in the media and by people on the left side of the aisle for doing back in 2002, 2003, and 2004. So the Obama administration is basically taking, you know, is replaying from the Bush playbook and really isn't having much pushback on it. The drones are a nice way to show results. Look, we killed a senior leader. Here he is. But the reality is that, again, they control territory. They have a deep recruiting base. And until we address those issues, and they're being sponsored by states, until we really address those issues, we can be conducting drone strikes all year round. And the other issue I have, by the way, with the drones is they're really only targeted in a small, very small area in North and South Waziristan, and more than 95% of the strikes occur there. The reality is that al-Qaeda is pervasive throughout all of Pakistan. Look at where we killed Osama bin Laden, where we captured Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and a whole host of other al-Qaeda leaders. It was all outside of the tribal areas in major Pakistani cities where they have support. This would be like me coming up with a plan to destroy the Ku Klux Klan, and I'd say, and we're going to do this by going into two counties in Alabama and dismantling the organization there, and therefore the Ku Klux Klan won't exist in the United States anymore. That is essentially our strategy.
Well, but my understanding is that this strategy is really in part to do with the backlash and the blowback from the boots-on-the-ground strategy, which was the Bush strategy, putting a huge army into an Islamic land, Iraq, and clearly the only winners so far of the Iraq war have been the Iranians, and the same in Afghanistan, and that this is why our policymakers find the drones attractive, because it's the opposite of boots on the ground.
Well, I think they find them, yeah, that is correct, but that doesn't mean it's a winning strategy either. They're attractive for several reasons. For the reason you just mentioned, if you don't want to get your hands dirty and invade another country or deny the enemy the space to operate in, that's one reason. It doesn't endanger American lives. And also, you have the issue that I discussed earlier, which is you could show easy results. I want to be real clear here, too. I think there's a certain fetishization of the drones themselves. I mean, whether, you know, people worry, oh, well, the remote killing. And the reality is if you're not sticking a knife in someone or strangling them with your bare hands, it's all remote killing. If I'm looking through a sight through a rifle at 200 yards and I shoot someone, I've killed them remotely. If I'm flying an aircraft at 20,000 feet and push a button to drop a bomb, I've killed them remotely. If I'm flying a drone and piloting 7,000 miles away, I also am killing them remotely. So people get really caught up in this technology and in this. And, you know, the reality is we used something else. We used cruise missiles, and we have all kinds of, you know, ground-launched long-range cruise missiles, and cruise missiles can be launched from ships and airplanes. The drones are really very little difference between, you know, the two technologies. It's just the next, next iteration of technology, but it's, I think there's a lot of emphasis put on the drones themselves and not the actual policies and the strategy and the tactics that we're employing to use them.
Well, just in closing, Bill Ruggiero, you're a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, and I just looked at the website and there's some fairly prominent neoconservatives in your organization, and there's no secret that they opposed the nomination of Chuck Hagel to be the next Secretary of Defense. What is the position that your organization's taken on John Brennan?
First, I wouldn't define us as a neoconservative. I certainly don't consider myself one. I can't speak for Foundation for Defense of Democracy's stand on Chuck Hagel. Honestly, I'm not tracking it that closely. I can only tell you my personal opinion. I don't believe he would make a very good Secretary of Defense. Some of the statements he's made with Iran or agreement with drawing down the military are things that I fundamentally disagree with. I could make the same argument, but I base it on the individual and not on a political party.
But he's been, if anybody has been the champion of the drone program, it's him.
Well, you're referring to John Brennan there.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah,
yes, it is John Brennan. And John Brennan has also has championed the drone program, but he's also, in my opinion, mischaracterized the intelligence used to attack al-Qaeda. For instance, in November 2011, he was basically telling everyone, well, there's just two senior al-Qaeda leaders left and the organization will collapse. We killed one of them in a drone strike, and the other one, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is still around. And guess what? Al-Qaeda is taking over a country in Mali. It's spread its insurgency into Syria. It's resurgent in Iraq. And it still has a leadership cadre inside of Afghanistan and conducts operations, in Pakistan and conducts operations in Afghanistan. And I just scratched the surface on the theaters that they're involved in. So that would be why I oppose Brennan for taking the tactic of drone strikes and using him as a strategy, as well as mischaracterizing the nature of al-Qaeda and its potency.
Well, Bill Roggio, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Bill Roggio, who's a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and the editor of their publication, The Long War Journal, which provides original reporting and analysis of the global war on terror. Coverage includes strategic and operational issues relating to the war in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, and Lebanon, as well as al-Qaeda's operations, tactics, and strategy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back getting an update on the economy and whether or not the Congress should take a Hippocratic oath in regard to the economy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James K. Galbraith, who is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Good to be with you.
And the current situation between the White House and the Congress over the economy with the sequester looming, and of course that's been delayed with the fiscal cliff deal, but it's coming up soon. Some people have suggested that the Congress should take the Hippocratic Oath on the economy. What's your suggestion?
Well, it would certainly be an improvement over their current practice, which is to do no good.
So what is their motive, though? Is it that so many of the Republicans in the House are free market ideologues, that they honestly believe that the sky is falling from the deficit, and that we have to, that is the priority, as opposed to reviving the economy in order to generate revenues?
Well, I think the concept of honest belief is a bit alien to the current American political discourse on these issues. What we are seeing is a targeted attack on particular public programs and public services, and behind targeted attacks, even if they come in under a cloud of propaganda, there is usually some economic interest. So, for example, I read in the paper today that the post office is planning to suspend and eliminate Saturday mail delivery. Does that mean that there will no longer be services available to do this? No, the private sector will, for a very substantially higher price, be willing to deliver packages for you on Saturdays. So this is something which has serves a very strong particular business interest. Similarly, when we hear proposals that were being spoken of just a few months ago to raise the eligibility age for Medicare. What you're looking at is a proposal to force the partial privatization of health care for that part of the population, which is in the age range of 65, 66, who would be obliged to continue to pay the premiums to private insurers. And so you can imagine there's a private economic interest behind that. And one can go down the list of these proposals. There's almost always somebody who is going to benefit from the curtailment of the public services and the public insurance, social insurance programs that we have built up over the years.
But James Galbraith, just recently there was a report on the fourth quarter of last year and how much growth dipped to an alarming degree, and much of that was attributed to a reduction in defense spending. So if that's a harbinger of what will happen if the sequester goes through and these enormous amount of money is taken out of the economy, we're talking about pretty much economics 101 here, and whether it's ideology or whether it's a desire on the part of the Republicans to frustrate and diminish Obama's ability to govern and essentially make his presidency fail, the consequences for America are pretty profound. So,
well, when we do have this mechanical effect that when the government cuts its purchases of goods and services in the fourth quarter, it was defense purchases, then that is a straightforward dollar-for-dollar reduction of GDP. So a generalized program to curtail government services, to, again, the Postal Service example, will reduce output directly. That doesn't mean that it isn't good business for some private enterprise. On the contrary. And so I think one can clearly infer the motives. I mean, you do have people. I saw that Speaker Boehner yesterday, the day before, said something to the effect that he was astonished that the president or somebody seemed to think that spending, government spending, adds to growth. Well, if he knew anything, and I'm sure he does know that, in fact, as a matter of accounting, if the government buys an aircraft carrier, that is added to total output and is an increase in the in economic activity and counts as economic growth. So one has to assume that Mr. Boehner is not completely ignorant of this, and that he's making a comment like this to obscure the issue for some other purpose. The other possibility is that he doesn't, in fact, know how the national economy works and how the accounting mechanisms actually work. But I find that to be a very remote possibility, frankly.
Again, I'm speaking with James K. Galbraith, who is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's the author of The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. But if these cuts go through and the economy this quarter will predictably, the growth will go down considerably. The Congressional Budget Office have already suggested that growth will go down to 1.1%. So you're getting close to two quarters in a row, which would indicate a return of a recession. So those stark facts have surely got to get their attention. Whether or not their financial backers who were looking at the post office to grab up post office real estate at a fire sale price, that notwithstanding, there are bigger issues here, surely.
Well, you would think so, but it's not obvious that those larger issues are of any concern to particular members of Congress. They have a concern about who is funding them, who is going to be supporting them in their next campaign, or about the threat they might face from an even more right-wing opponent in a primary. And that's a direct, immediate concern to a member of Congress. The possibility that somebody, most likely, you know, most people in some other district, will become unemployed as a result, or that the nation might enter a recession, is a much more remote issue as far as this particular kind of political atmosphere is concerned. Clearly.
So if they go ahead with these automatic cuts, and as the CBO recently predicted, it will reduce growth by 1.5% of GDP, do you think that we'll officially be in another recession, or the last one has come back? I don't quite know.
Well, the reality is that the crisis that began in 2007 and came to a climax in 2008, has never really ended. We have a far smaller share of the population actually employed now than was true 4 or 5 years ago. And yes, we hit bottom, and the basic mechanisms that we have available to stabilize the economy did work and have worked, and we've experienced a little bit of economic expansion since the bottom was hit, but a full recovery hasn't happened. So I'm reluctant to say that, you know, talk in terms of a new crisis. The reality is we're in a fundamentally different world. Am I really concerned about the possibility that we're going to have another very sharp downturn, repeat the experience of 2009? I think that's a bit remote, precisely because we still do have the stabilizing mechanisms, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Federal Reserve is still there. These institutions are still there. They're still available to do their jobs. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is still assuring people that the money they have in the bank is safe. And I think these institutions, for the moment, are still functioning. Will the steps that you're describing make matters more difficult? Yes, they will. They'll make matters substantially more difficult for quite a few people. No question about it.
Well, the president, of course, has tried to head off the sequester by suggesting an interim step of making some cuts and some increases in revenue and postponing the day of reckoning here, if you will. Now, he got pretty soundly and somewhat derisively shot down by Speaker Boehner. And I find myself in an odd situation defending defense spending here, but the Pentagon officials have said that up to 800,000 of the military civilian employees would have to work one day less a week because of the cuts, and the Air Force would have to curtail orders of Lockheed Martin's F-35 fighter jet, which is probably an extremely good idea, frankly, because it's a complete turkey. But they'd also delay a new version of the Reaper drone, which obviously is very much in demand in terms of the Pentagon's current needs as opposed to the F-35, which is a Cold War, incredibly expensive and obsolete toy. So I guess what I'm saying here is that you can really see what a blunt instrument this sequester is.
Well, I think that's true. In the case of the defense budget, what is happening is that we're looking at a number that's going to come down anyway. It was blown up to an extraordinarily high level in the excitement of the Bush years, the aftermath of 9/11, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, and those numbers are coming down. It would have been an extremely good thing if we had used this pressure of the sequester to have a rational reevaluation of what we're spending the defense money on, and you mentioned the F-35 is a very important example of that. Of course, the reality is that as we did that, whether it was something driven by the sequester or something driven by a rational reexamination of what our national security needs are, it's going to be taking spending out of the economy. I can't deny that. And then the question is, how do we maintain the overall level of spending? What national needs should we be pursuing that we have not yet funded properly, both in the public sector and in the private sector? And that's a conversation we should be having. But the notion here that that we're actually have the two poles of the debate are, as you have said, this completely misleading and meretricious argument that comes from Speaker Boehner and his acolytes that says that we should be somehow, as we cut spending, we're going to get an increase in economic growth directly as a result of it. And then on the president's side, the kind of defensive reaction which says we shouldn't cut spending precipitously, so we'll cut it a little bit and hope to defer the big cuts until some later time when somehow miraculously the economy will have recovered, which is also it's a defensive argument. You can make more excuses for it, but it is not going to, it's an argument which is still very far away from a direct and effective attack on the actual problems that we face. Such an approach would require us to rethink and recast the way we talk about these problems and not to be in the position of saying, oh, well, the government spending, whatever it's for, is always a drag on the economy, something which is not true.
Well, I don't know whether data and facts play a part in this, the politics of the moment. One would hope that there is some kind of economic patriotism and some...
You're an optimist.
Well, at least a recognition of reality and
you're even more of an optimist.
Well, a belief in data. Then I'm truly ridiculous.
He's doubling down on his optimism.
Well, but I mean, the Congressional Budget Office just projected that the federal budget deficit will drop to 5.3% of the nation's total output by the end of the year. So I guess that nobody noticed that on the conservative side or the Tea Party side. And that's roughly half of what the deficit was relative to the size of the economy in 2009. So are the deficit hawks operating on fumes here? What's going on?
Oh, I do think that the lobbying groups that have been set up, the front organizations that the Peterson Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, established in Washington to continually drone on about this issue, have run out of credibility. They have been playing the little boy who cried wolf for years now, saying that 2 years ago they were saying that there would be a major crisis in the financial markets if we didn't got Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid by now. Well, we haven't done it, and there is absolutely no sign of a crisis in the financing of the U.S. government. So their credibility on this question is really quite shot. What you have instead is a kind of much more raw and, and in many ways, really a direct attack on government functions as such. And that's what's emerging from the Republican side right now. It's clear that as the deficit issue, the so-called debt problem loses credibility, what they are saying is directly what they mean, which is that they want to cut back on government services. They want to cut back on the public sector. They want to privatize things in order that their clients in the private sector can profit from it. What is becoming clear is a very transparent view of the motives behind this.
So, James Galbraith, if Pete Peterson, who's a Wall Street billionaire, if his real motives are to get rid of Social Security so the stock market can get its hands on all of that money, obviously that's what George W. Bush proposed when he was reelected and when he said, I've got some political capital now and I'm going to spend it. And he went ahead with this plan to privatize Social Security. And had we privatized Social Security with the subsequent crash in 2008, every American would be incredibly impoverished. So I don't understand how, one, Peterson can make that argument in the light of what just happened, and two, why the Obama administration bought into the Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction package, which was in part financed by Pete Peterson, who paid the salaries of the staff of the Simpson-Bowles Commission.
Well, let's separate things out here. I do think that, as I said, Pete Peterson's arguments have lost credibility, and his operations, which include a number of front organizations in Washington, have basically been reduced to caricatures of themselves. You're quite right that had we privatized or cut back Social Security when President Bush proposed it, then we would not have had the stabilizing effect that Social Security did have on the economy in 2009. It was a major force in preventing everything from going completely to hell. And so that's something which is extremely important. Eric Larson has a book called The People's Pension, The History of the Social Security Wars, in which he documents this really quite impressively. On the question of the motivations of the White House in setting up a commission, I think we have to be agnostic. I'm sure there were people in the White House who were hoping that the commission would come up with a program that would cover the administration in deficit-cutting glory. There may have been other people in the White House who felt that the purpose of a commission is to kick an issue down the road until it dies and nothing happens. And if there were such people, they were, it's hard to fault them. The Simpson-Bowles Commission, blathered on for a while, produced a report which its own commissioners would not vote for, in which, for example, its Paul Ryan did not vote for it. Then they have been talking about it ever since as though it were some great heroic document, which it is not. But the reality is that nothing came of it, which is good.
Well, just in closing, James Galbraith, you mentioned in an article that you supported Jack Lew for Treasury. Do you think he'll be an improvement over Geithner? Because one of the main criticisms now that's coming out about Geithner as a result of the PBS documentary on that questioned why nobody on Wall Street's gone to jail for the crash of the economy, and a lot of fingers are pointed to Geithner and, of course, Lenny Brewer at the Justice Department. But will Lew be an improvement, at least not necessarily putting bankers in jail? But what is
The failure of the prosecution of massive bank fraud lies with the Justice Department, not with the Treasury Department. But it's fair to say that under Secretary Geithner, the Treasury Department was the leading voice for the view that you couldn't do anything to the banking sector that they might disapprove of, because that would cause all kinds of unimaginable harm. And this was extremely frustrating to serious regulators, including Sheila Bair, a Republican appointee, who documents the obstruction and difficulties she faced from the Treasury Department through her term into President Obama's administration in a very good book called Bull by the Horns. So we have the record of that very clear. Jack Lew, I really can't speak to how he will perform. He's someone whom I knew and liked and respected a lot when we were both very young members of the staff of the U.S. Congress in the early 1980s. He is a lifelong public servant with a record of accomplishment, really, and capable administration at the Office of Management and Budget. And so far as anyone, so far as I know, as the chief of staff in the White House, and I expect that he will bring an independent point of view to the Treasury Department. So I think it's a good appointment. It's an appointment certainly that the Senate should confirm easily. I'm sure it will. I'm looking forward to seeing how Jack does it as Secretary of the Treasury. I think we can judge that performance after we've seen it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, James Galbraith.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith, who is a professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.